In order to explain what I want to offer today about the character of Yehuda, I have to just review his life with you in a minute because some of you may have forgotten the details of the story. Remember, all the brothers, when Joseph comes to them, what do they want to do to Joseph? They want to kill him. And Judah says, nah, we don't get any benefit from killing him. Let's just sell him into slavery. Now, you ask yourself, did Judah really want to sell him into slavery, or did he want to try to save him, but he thought he would meet too much opposition if he said, "Dad, don't kill him, you know, he's our brother, let's bring him back home." Ask yourself that question, we will return to it in a moment. Then all of a sudden, in the middle of the Joseph story, there is chapter 38, which is this curious intrusion of a completely different story about Judah. And there's a lot of discussion about why it's in the middle of the Joseph story, but I just want to offer you one possible reason. First of all, let's recall what happens in chapter 38. Judah's oldest son, Er, that's his name, and presumably that's what he is, he marries Tamar, and he dies. So, because he had no children, it is his brother's obligation to provide him with children, and Onan then doesn't have sex with Tamar, and in the process of not having sex with her, he dies. You can look at the text for the details. So Judah starts to think, you know, okay, once I understand. Twice I'm beginning to see a pattern here. I have a third son named Shelah. According to the law, I'm supposed to give Tamar to Shelah, but Shelah is still a minor. I'm going to send her away, which he does, and he says, when he grows up, I'll marry you off to him, but of course he has no intention of doing that. But he doesn't tell her. So she's stuck somewhere, waiting for Judah's third son, unable to marry, unable to bear children, by herself, and Judah never says to her, incidentally, there's no chance in the world that you're going to get my third kid. So what does she do? She disguises herself as, let us see, there are children here. As somebody who would work in a house of ill repute, as someone who practiced the world's oldest profession, and if you don't know what either of those mean, then ask another adult nearby. And when she sees Judah, she asks him for his staff and his seal, which are what you used in the ancient world as your identification marks. The literary critic Robert Alter says it's the equivalent of asking you for all your major credit cards. And she takes them because he doesn't have the means to pay her at the moment. She says, I will hold these until you come back and pay me. When he comes back, she's disappeared, and he doesn't know why. And as it turns out, of course, she gets pregnant. She eventually reveals herself to Judah, saying, you know, I'm Tamar. I'm actually your daughter-in-law, although you didn't know that when you slept with me because she had her face masked, as apparently such women did in ancient times, when they were more innocent than today, and they couldn't advertise on the web. And she says to him, actually, this is what happened. And now Judah knows that this woman has tricked him, is responsible in his mind for the death of two of his children, and is now pregnant from him. What's he going to do? So, file a lawsuit. So what he does is, he says, Tzadka mimeni, you are more righteous than I. You were right and I was wrong. Now, in what way does this show Judah's growth? Not only because he admits that he was wrong, which in and of itself, of course, is an indicator of growth. But remember last week, when we talked about why it is that Esau and Jacob get reconciled, and one of the reasons is that Esau's experience of Jacob is every time he gets in trouble, he runs away. When he got in trouble as a kid, he ran away. And now he comes before Jacob, and he's no longer running away. He stands before him. The same thing is true in a different sense of Judah. Judah does not have emotional/spiritual courage. Instead of saying to his brothers, we can't sell our brother into slavery or kill him. We have to bring him home. We may hate him, but he's our brother. What does he do? He takes the easier way out. He saves Joseph's life, which is good, but he does it by selling him into slavery. The same thing with his third son. We understand why he wants to save his third son. That makes sense. But instead of saying to Tamar, look, I'm not going to marry you to my third son. I'm just not going to do it. And I release you and you can marry someone else or whatever it is that he would say, he avoids the confrontation by sending her off and then just never contacting her again. But here for the first time, he actually stands up. He stands in front of her and he says, you're right and I was wrong. And he doesn't run away. And he doesn't pretend it didn't happen. And he doesn't take his staff and seal, which he could because she confronts him privately, and just leave and abandon her and the child that she's going to have. That will all be important because when Judah is involved then in the story of Joseph and recovering his brother at the end, when Joseph reveals himself and before, Judah has clearly been transformed. He's become an adult from being a child because there's something essentially childlike and childish about not being willing to confront the consequences of your actions. So he says to Tamar, you were right, and I was wrong. And part of the reason that this story is inserted in the Joseph story is it's about the maturation, it's about the growth of a human being. And that's going to be important, of course, not only for the story of Joseph and his brothers, but eventually for the liberation of Israel from Egypt. Because it's only when Israel's willing to take responsibility for themselves as a free people at the end of the Torah that they're ready to go into Eretz Yisrael and, as we know, ready to become the one kingdom that survived, which was the kingdom of Yehuda, of Judah. Okay, let's bring everybody.